Welcome to The Daily Friend Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to The Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Ms. Sara Gant. Sara, how are you?
Hi. Well, thanks, Nick. And you?
I'm pretty good. And Mr. Herman Pretorius, who I will note for all of our listeners, is may be a bit strange today because he is extremely sleep-deprived because being the committed soldier of liberty he is, he stayed up the entire night to watch the U.S. vice presidential debate. So we're definitely going to have to talk about that today to make his sacrifice worth it. He was also on a panel discussion on – where was it, Herman?
It was Newsroom Africa.
Newsroom Africa. But anyway – glad to have you on the show with us, and thank you for making the time, even though you should probably be sleeping.
Yeah, just full disclosure, I can see sounds and hear colors.
All right, so I'm sure your analysis today will be extra interesting.
I can hear racism. Oh no, sorry, that's just Julius Malema saying something.
So let's get stuck into our first topic today, which is that structural adjustment is not a choice anymore, but a necessity. So says the South African Chamber of Commerce and Industry. They published yesterday the Business Confidence Index, which shows that basically the upshot is that there's been a decline and that we are on their index 6.7 points below where we were in September. Over the first 9 months of this year, we averaged 84.3 on their index, whereas last year we were 92.6. And I believe that's a fall, too, from the high years after Ramaphosa came in, when business confidence sort of went up. But that's steadily been going down since, as people, I think, have begun to fear that structural reform is not particularly imminent. In fact, we seem to be going in the opposite direction with NHI, with EWC, with prescribed assets. And then there was another story as well, which adds to this problem, which is that SARS was giving a presentation in Parliament a few days ago, and the situation doesn't look good. They're projecting a revenue shortfall of 304 billion rand for 2020-2021 financial year. And all of this, I guess, is leading up to what's going to happen later in the month, which is Tito Mboweni's midterm budget adjustment statement, where he's going to basically update the finances of the country and tell us where we're at since February. And of course, a lot has changed since February. You've got a little bit of an indication of what he might be saying based on his update in June. But a lot of people are saying the financial chickens are going to come home to roost. Herman, to avoid calamity, what can Tito Mboweni, what choices does he need to make and push for in government?
Well, before I answer that, let me say one thing that is, I think, just so precious from Corporate South Africa and the Chamber of Commerce. The idea that, you know, to call for structural reform and to say structural reform is necessary is the policy wonk or economic policy wonk equivalent of, you know, just yelling at a pigeon saying something must be done. The frustration with the concept of structural reform is it is a bit like fairness in the sense that every person has their own idea of what it means. It is the most fudgy term that could possibly be used in economic policy because for the ANC, expropriation without compensation qualifies as structural reform. Prescribed assets, a massive expenditure on infrastructure, NHI, all of these things can be, you know, hidden under the loving cloak of structural reform. So whenever Corporate South Africa or a Chamber of Commerce comes out and says, you know, structural reform is now very, very, very needed. Just remember that it's the equivalent of, you know, a slightly hungover man yelling at a pigeon in Trafalgar Square. It is really just the most nothing statement that could possibly be done. Once you qualify the structural reform, something like pro-growth structural reform or growth-enhancing structural reform, at least you give it some content. You say that, you know, there's an objective here. It's not just someone do something. It is how about someone do something to actually get economic growth going. So whenever you hear the phrase, you know, structural reform, very, very necessary, and you know, the big labor, big business, and big government nod solemnly along, they are all thinking, yep, yeah, my idea of structural reform, stricter BEE, less BEE, prescribed assets, more investment in pension funds or from pension funds in infrastructure. All sins are covered by the vapid term of structural reform.
I think that's an extremely good point. You have to be able to name something in order to face it. And I think we've seen a lot of that in the prescribed assets debate, where even naming the possibility of prescribed assets and the panic that that could cause is, and we talked about it yesterday, is seen as more of a threat than prescribed assets itself.
Yes, it really is kind of a weird Twilight Zone situation where I was on 702 the other day, and I really just have to read you the headline. It's precious. The headline is prescribing assets : IRR is, quote, stirring up panic, unquote, about ANC accessing pensions. Now, imagine reading that and thinking, ah, yeah, those IRR people, really, really a risk to the country. Literally in the same breath where it says, you know, ANC accessing pensions. I mean, that's like paedophile accessing primary school. It is the worst possible combination of it's just a recipe for disaster. But on the question of what can be done, what should be done, there is no money. So there is only a fixed list of options for any government wanting to, you know, get money somewhere. One, raise taxes. Can't really do that. Revenue shortfall already, you know, not a dark cloud as much as, you know, just a comet hurtling at us. Secondly, we can cut expenditure. That is politically just not feasible. And you will see Cassato and the unions making that very, very clear over coming weeks. Thirdly, you can attempt to borrow money. But we are sub-investment grade on all three rating agencies. So borrowing money, not much of an option. So the two things that remain is you can print money or you can grab some assets. So I'm painting a very, very dark picture here, because what Tito Mboweni is, by mere, you know, cancelling out the options that he does not have, you end up at a place where you either stare hyperinflation in the face through the printing of money, or you stare the destruction of property rights in the face through the seizure of investment fund savings and pensions. So what must Tito Mboweni do to save the country? Well, genuinely, give South Africa a government transplant.
Sara, for a second there, I thought Herman had learned a lot from the vice presidential debate and was going to skillfully evade my question, but he did return to it in the end. I guess I'm going to ask you a little bit about, firstly, well, what you think about what Herman just said. And secondly, mm-hmm. you know, is, I guess one can view Tito Mboweni in a lot of different ways. And I think it's difficult, unless you're really in the bowels of government, to know which of these is true. But you could see him either as the least effective reformer in the world, because he's failed to stop a lot of things, or the sort of titan, the Atlas holding up what remains of the South African economy, and without him would be even worse than it is. Which do you think is closer to the truth?
Idiosyncratic as he is, I would give him the more sort of positive, heroic support, because he essentially is the only person in government who is batting for the people of South Africa. And that's probably why he vacillates between making a lot of statements that are make huge amounts of sense, and then periodically veering off into the unknown where the rest of his colleagues inhabit.
Well, he's been a bit warm to prescribed assets, but presumably that's simply to protect the country from printing money.
He said often enough that we require structural change, and he's indicated what sort of change it is. And essentially, it's a move to the sort of stuff we need, which is free markets, deregulation, etc. But he can't, you know, he's got no one, virtually no one, to support him in that. In fact, I think most of the NEC of the ANC is just looking to bury him as soon as is humanly possible. So he's really got to get up there and say things that no one on his side wants to hear or support. And that's why you end up having – he'll probably say some of the right things and then not do a great deal, because he's really caught between a rock and a hard place. But to go to the I just want to mention something apropos what Herman said about the business sector. Absolutely. There are two problems with the business sector. One is that they're always about a year behind every other opinion maker in the country as regards to how the government is doing and what it should be doing. And then when they finally catch up and they say that the government must do that or the government must stop doing that, it's couched, as you say, in the sort of structural reform without using words like free market deregulation, etc. And I think one of the biggest problems is that the big business sector in particular keeps giving succor to the ANC that it has alternatives, but it will put them forward in the context of a social compacting arrangement. I don't think the ANC is any different to any other playground bully. If you challenge them and if you actually fight against them and you let your voice be heard, they'll back off. And I think to some extent this is what Senecal was about. The fact that, I mean, look, one's not condoning the violence that a handful of protesters embarked upon in order to make their point about Senecal, but it's the very fact that there have been increasing protests on a substantial scale against farm murders. Certainly, Franz Cronier is sort of saying that this is a tipping point and that they are fighting back and they're being seen to fight back, and they might now finally get a decent reaction from government. The same applies with business. If you get the sort of responses we've got from Saki and from Asisa regarding prescribed assets, this is always the problem. You cannot wait until, as Herman's famously talked about, putting things on the table and not being able to see the table. The problem is that there's no understanding of how the political process works, and that if you get to that point, you are in a weakened state already. You're already on your knees. It's just from there to the legislature, and the legislation is passed. So any opposition, and this applies to EWC, it applies to prescribed assets, and applies to the economy. If you see things going wrong, which undoubtedly people have long time seen, you attack it. You do not get caught in a miasma of Ramaphoria. You attack it and you give your reasons for attacking it and you stand by it. But maybe that's a step too far courage-wise.
Indeed so. Herman, final thoughts?
Yeah, I must say, on the prescribed assets thing, I think this lily-lividness was made perfectly clear by Signia's statement on prescribed assets. It starts out very, very promisingly. It's like a Schubert symphony. It just starts wonderfully, and then, and then syphilis takes over. But it just at the end, they after saying prescribed assets no, prescribed assets niet, then in the last few paragraphs they say, but if you really must, government, Mr. Ramaphosa, Mr. Mboweni, if you really, really must do prescribed assets, then it would be, we would be amenable to the possibility of a deal under these circumstances. Thank you very much. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. We have the situation where not even their statements can cohere to the concept of a spine. You start at one place saying we will oppose prescribed assets with everything we've got, And in the last paragraph, you have the seeding of the principle and the declaration of the savings and pensions of ordinary South Africans as bargaining chips. And I get so frustrated because it's not like there isn't a case study of a financial or an economic sector in South Africa, not just, you know, burning its fingers, but burning itself to a crisp in totality. You have the mining sector who thought they could placate an ideological government into some form of pragmatism. And they gave up things like mineral rights, one of the first knocks against property rights in this country. And ever since then, the mining sector of South Africa, that was really once a power player in the world when it came to things like gold and platinum, has just been utterly, utterly decimated. And it is squarely to be laid before the door of the Nedluckians of big government, big labor, and big business.
Well said. Let us move on now, because we are going a bit over time, to the reason that you are sleep-deprived and delirious, Herman, which is, of course, last night was a vice presidential debate between Vice President Mike Pence and aspirant Vice President Kamala Harris, in which, well, I think a lot of people took away from it. They seem to have read into it largely their predispositions. And it was a lot more civil, and I think it exposed a lot of weaknesses in both campaigns, actually. My impression of the thing was that both contenders were very good at exposing the other's weakness, but not so much necessarily covering their own side's weaknesses. Herman, what was your take on the thing, since you watched the whole thing from beginning to end?
Yes, I think a fundamental thing is that the moment both sides can claim a win, you're looking at something of a draw. And I do think it was something of a draw, perhaps with Pence a whisker in front, for a few reasons. Firstly, he needed to stabilize the ship after the rocky debate performance in the previous debate of Donald Trump, and of course with the COVID-19 diagnosis of the president and the first lady. And with his, you know, baritonal approach and the good old trained voice of radio, Mike Pence really managed to assert some structure, or at least, you know, impose some semblance of ideological coherence to a government that is, I think, almost deliberately chaotic by the design of the president, who enjoys the fractious nature and the competitive nature of you know, a slightly a dog-eat-dog world, and a presidency that has been trying to get in, Infrastructure Week on the calendar for approximately 3.5 years and failing every time because of some tweet. So what struck me about Harris's performance is it was very much about her. She didn't say, of course, she mentioned Joe Biden a lot, but you didn't get the impression that she was punting for Biden, where Pence was quite clearly there as an ambassador for Trump. So I don't know if that was deliberate. If it was deliberate, it was clearly designed to establish her credibility as a possible commander-in-chief to who would be the oldest president elected in American history. If it's accidental and it's not, a part of such a strategy for credibility, then I think it was actually a terrible, an awful performance by Harris, because one of the fundamental rules of being a VP candidate is you do not outshine the number one name on the ticket. But I must say there were some good points from Pence, some good zingers from Harris. And a frustrating thing to me from Pence was they had, I think, a good riposte on the handling of the COVID-19 crisis at last, comparing it to the swine flu incident or epidemic in 2009, when Joe Biden was, of course, vice president. It was a coherent attack line that I'm frustrated that I'm only hearing a month or 3 weeks before the election.
So with that in mind, Sarah, and considering everything Herman's just said, I want to put to you a thing that was suggested by a commentator online, which I can't remember who it was, but he suggested that in a lot of ways, just as Herman here said that Harris mustn't outshine Biden, that Pence may have done damage to Trump because he did more damage to the Biden-Harris campaign by himself when he had the spotlight for a change than Trump has managed to do in a couple months. Do you buy that, or do you think that that might be overstating the case?
Yeah, I might be overstating the case, and from this, in the sense that even Trump, whether he'll acknowledge it or not, Trump had to know that there was huge criticism about his performance in the first debate, that he just, in choosing to go at it in his normal style, he lost opportunities left, right, and center. Pence had to tidy up after that considerable degree. And the other thing is, by his nature, he's used to being the vice president. He's used to being more measured. He's used to not being in the limelight. I don't think that Trump would have had a problem if he'd tidy things up, because he knows his place and we know his place. Whereas Kamala Harris, I think everyone, probably including her, assumes that her place is in the Oval Office before Joe Biden's term ends. I think he's kind of the rational voice that Trump never is. So I'm not sure that it would be a problem for Trump, because, you know, he's there to be the straight guy, if I can put it like that. Pence is, I mean.
Yeah. I'm always amused by how Pence looks exactly like if you were watching a movie and there was a stereotypical American president that was in the film, who was just there as a background character, would look like Mike Pence.
I mean, he has the neatest haircut I have ever seen.
Yes. And yesterday, the thing that got a lot of people excited on Twitter was a fly landed on his head while he was talking during the debate, and he didn't react to it. It seems to sit there for about 2 minutes.
That's impressive.
Herman, any final thoughts, any response to the suggestion I laid out about Pence's performance?
I must say, I think I'm quite with Sarah on this, Pence has been a very, very good vice president to, I think, a very difficult president to, you know, be the safe pair of hands, but a safe pair of hands never really visible unless, you know, absolutely called for. So I don't think Pence outshone Trump. And I think that's you know, by nature and by design. So what I do think is fascinating that if a fly on the head of the vice president is, you know, the most memorable bit of a debate, then we have fallen very far from what I consider to be the high point of vice presidential debates in the year 2000, when Dick Cheney and Joe Lieberman had one of the greatest political debates, I think, in history. It's just a good hour and a half of two smart, policy understanding politicians going at it with humor, but with intelligence and insight, something that, you know, we haven't seen in a while.
Oh, we have fallen far. There's no doubt.
I have one final story I just want to leave our listeners with. There is a rumor in Washington, D.C. that the office of Mike Pence is filled entirely with portraits of vice presidents who later became president. So make of that what you will. let's go to the next story. And this is a bit of a weird one. So the other night we all got very excited because suddenly over the wire came a story from independent media IOL, which announced that Ace Magashula, the Secretary General of the ANC and the former Premier of the Free State, was in danger of being arrested. And included a quote from him where Magashula said, I know, it will be a Hollywood-style type thing, was the phrase he used. But we shall see, I think is how the quote from him read. However, very strangely, very shortly after, the Hawks, who are allegedly serving the arrest warrant, said that unless it was another Hawks that they didn't know about, it wasn't them. Ace Magashula released a statement saying that it was fake news. And he said, for now, my lawyers will be in touch with the NPA so that we verify this. For now, I'm saying there is no need to panic. No need for any Hollywood style of arrest because I'm a law-abiding citizen. I've not done anything that is wrong, according to me, and unlawful. So this is a bit strange because the story has now sort of fallen into the ether. I think someone wrote an opinion piece about it saying that Ace Magashule is spooked and on the ropes or something like that. But I don't take that particularly seriously. And we also know that IOL is quite close to the Magashule faction of the ANC. So, Sarah, I guess my question to you is, what the frick is going on here?
And my answer is, hell if I know. I'm not quite sure what the tactic would have been in putting out the information, other than to, in denying it later, be able to say that he's a good law-abiding citizen, which after we'd got over our disappointment of learning that the statement wasn't true about his arrest, we would all have guffawed and gone to bed. There probably was a distinct tactic around it, but bugger if I know what it is.
So, Herman, what I find interesting is that in the supposedly fake news story, there's this quote from him about a Hollywood-style thing. And then in the statement that Magashule himself put out, he once again makes a reference to a Hollywood style of arrest, which kind of makes me think that he may have been the author of both quotes, which would suggest really that there is some skullduggery at work. What do you make of it, Herman?
Yeah, I mean, Ace Magashule and skullduggery, I know. I definitely think that there's some skullduggery here. And it goes to as to why. And I've been trying to figure out why. And it's been an exhausting task because it means I have to think like Ace Magashule. And I think sleep deprivation really accommodates that state of mind. And it really seems to me, if it's going to be political and strategic and tactical, it is either a testing of the waters to see who comes to his defense, who rises jubilantly at the prospect of his downfall. So it might be that, but I mean, we're really into, cloak and assegai kind of politics here. And then the other possibility is that he might know that there's something coming down the pipeline and he wanted to spring on this issue, pounce as it were, before those coming after him have their, house in order, have their case ready for a prosecution and, jump the gun in that way. I can't think of another explanation. I think you're right, Lauren and Nick, that there is definitely the phraseology of the Hollywood style thing. It's just so convenient. IOL, it just smacks of a bit of a, a soprano C plot in some sort of mid-season filler episode. So I do think that it is definitely gangster state-esque. And in terms of why, well, those are the two options as a smoking out supporters or detractors, or possibly jumping the gun and trying to catch his opponents off guard. Beyond that, I mean, to quote the great Saragon, bugger if I know.
Nick, can I just say two things in response to that? The one is that I don't think anyone would react prematurely to the news of his arrest in the ANC because no one is going to expose themselves too quickly. They're going to hang back. And the second thing is I'm begging him to not deprive us of the Hollywood moment. I do want to see Ace Magashule being taken out in handcuffs. You know, when a policeman sort of puts a hand on top of their head while he gets into the car so that they don't bash the head and then sue the police department for injury. I want to see that. And, I think he wants us to – I think he wants to give it to us when the time comes.
And, I mean, I didn't think I would be saying this in this podcast recording, but, 2020, you can redeem yourself in some way. Give us them visuals of the Hollywood moment.
I definitely think that would be quite something to be sure. I also don't know entirely what to make of this whole thing. It is a bit of a strange occurrence. And if he is going to get arrested, it's going to set off, I think, a bit of a chain reaction of chaos inside the ANC, because it means that the Ramaphosa faction is really making a move. But we shall see. Maybe the story is coming back. There's quite a bunch of things that Magashule could be taken down for, everything from giving a Pioneer painting to one of his bodyguards to, I think, what this one was supposed to be about, which is that dairy farm project, which he claims he wasn't involved in at all, but numerous people close to him in the Free State were involved in. Anyway, I think that's all there is for today. So thank you very much for listening. We hope that you have a wonderful weekend, as we will see you again on Monday. Please remember to rate, comment, subscribe, leave us reviews, all that good stuff. And we'll check you out next week on The Daily Print Show. Have a great week, everyone.